From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative health care, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. With us today, Norman Cohan. He is an author and speaker, ancient astronaut researcher. He's also the creator of a transformational software, which is a biocomputer program. It's a new art form. It's a new use of language as a catalyst to changing consciousness. We are going to speak specifically today about a gentleman that he has read quite a bit about, Zechariah Sitchin. Welcome to the show, Norman.
Hello, Bruce. Hello, everybody.
All right, Zechariah Sitchin.
Zechariah Sitchin was born in Russia. He lived most of his life in Israel and the United States. He's a linguist, an archaeologist, one of the few people on the planet that's able to read the original Sumerian inscriptions. And it's his interpretations of these olden texts from Sumeria 6,000 years ago that we're most interested in. Well, I'd like to give some background to the entire ancient astronaut theory. There's three phases. In the 70s, many people will remember Chariots of the Gods. Eric von Daniken's recognized as the father of ancient astronaut theory. There's a good side to that and a bad side. He popularized the ideas. His books were bestsellers. Millions and millions of people were presented with the idea of extraterrestrial visitations to the planet in the past. But at the same time, he speculated and he had some unproven theories that were jumped upon by the skeptics and basically discredited this idea for many people. Unfortunately, they prematurely closed their account with the entire theory after the Eric von Daniken situation. But after him, some scientists, especially Maurice Chatelain, who was a NASA scientist who developed the radar which guided the first Apollo missions to the moon, and Joseph Blumrich, another scientist who specifically set out to disprove von Daniken's theories, wrote a book called The Spaceships of Ezekiel, where he attempted to show the absurdity of Ezekiel's vision of the Bible being contact with an extraterrestrial spacecraft. But as he studied the text in greater detail, he was astonished to find out how accurate the ancient records were in relation to projects that he was involved with in building spacecraft and moon landing modules.
So once again, someone began to disprove, and of course we hear about this in the ufology community quite often. Someone starts out with their agenda to go out and disprove all of the information they've read, and usually take an about face somewhere after a few years of research.
Exactly. I call it an ideological barrier. There's so many ideas that we've been conditioned with, especially about ancient history, that really comes out of, I'll say ignorance, but it's just lack of study of the subject. And that causes skepticism in most people's part without even studying the material.
Well, because historically, we in the Western world study war to war. That's how we study history. And yet, this is a different angle. This is not war to war.
Well, this is looking at ancient history not through the window of Greek and Roman times, which most people think of ancient history, but this is looking further back to the origins of life on the planet. In fact, we're looking back at the origins of the planet Earth and the current solar system, the entire story of creation, it could be called.
So what happened? He was out to disprove the Ezekiel story.
And it turns out that there's many what we call ooparts, which are out of place and time artifacts that are discovered, whether they're archaeolinguistic, which means certain words that are found in ancient scriptures that just shouldn't be there. They refer to some technology that didn't exist at the time these texts were written, or actual artifacts such as the pyramids, the ziggurats, and temples of ancient Sumeria that seem to represent a level of technology far in advance to the people who lived at that time. And when Sitchin came on the scene, he expounded a specific theory of ancient astronauts, which is what I'd like to talk about right today.
Sitchin was not just some researcher in the UFO community, but rather his information has penetrated the UFO community because of his scholarly attempts to look at the Sumerian culture. Is that correct?
Well, exactly. He has spent his life in the greatest libraries of the world, looking up the origins of the Nephilim. When Sitchin was a child, he asked why in Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, it says, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and in the days after." And the word Nephilim in Hebrew was translated as giants, when he knew, having grown up speaking Hebrew, that the word meant those who came down from above. And this seemed to thrust him on his quest for the origins of the Nephilim.
So we have two, we have a paradox here. How did he know that Nephilim meant those who came from above? I didn't know that.
Oh, it's a direct literal translation of the word. I don't know if you're familiar with ancient Aramaic or Hebrew, but he was.
So the translation in the King James Version of the Bible, it says there were giants on the earth, I can't think of anything else better than to say that was wrong.
Well, exactly. I mean, over the centuries, there's...
I'm just, for the sake of the story today, it seems that this may be a mistranslation.
There have been many editorial changes, of course, in the Bible, the Old Testament, other scripture throughout time. Fortunately, not everything has been edited out, and the mention of these beings called the Nephilim, also called the sons of God, still remains in Genesis.
Now, they had a home planet, obviously.
They did, and this is all spoken of in these olden records of the Sumerians. We can talk about that a bit. The first few chapters of Genesis, it turns out, are merely fragments of a lost teaching that within the last 100 years in southern Iraq, which was ancient Babylon and Assyria and Sumeria, we discovered the library of King Ashurbanipal, and he was an Assyrian king who collected all the ancient records up until that time. And when we started translating these texts, it tells this remarkable story about the Nephilim who came from a planet called Nibiru. And it's a planet within our solar system that has a 3,600-year orbit around our sun. It goes against the ecliptic of the other planets in our solar system. And the ancient Sumerians always spoke of their 12 planets, which was the 9 that we know of, the sun and the moon, and Nibiru as the 12th planet.
Okay, hold on, because I'm sure that a lot of people, this has gone by fast. We're talking about a planet that is, as we discussed before, 4 times the size of the Earth. Was that right? 4 times?
4 or 5 times.
Okay. This is a big planet.
It's a large planet that modern scientists have detected through the perturbations of the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. They've postulated this large planet somewhere out beyond the orbits of Neptune and Pluto and approaching our solar system.
So that its cycle, it has a different cycle. Most of these planets, let's see, I can't remember what Pluto's cycle is, but it's certainly not 3,600 years. But we can see Pluto because it is not that far away. If this planet were, for example, at its furthest point, has anyone any idea how far that would be?
Well, they've narrowed it down to it being in the southern sky, and it is so far away coming in, as you say, from such a radically different angle that it's hard to scan the entire skies to find something as small as a planet. But the ancient records talk a lot about Nibiru and its various times that it crossed the paths of the other planets and the cosmic collisions that took place. Would you like to hear some of the tales of
Well, I'd like to hear the tales, but I want to just dwell on this for a moment. So we're talking about a planet that's about four or five times the size of the Earth, which has an apogee and a perigee, which we don't know about, but we do know that it takes 3,600 years for it to go through one complete cycle around the sun, so to speak.
All right.
So that would mean that if it had been here 1,800 years ago, and someone had seen it, I'm just trying to get a perspective here, that would mean that it would be at its furthest point now, which would be 1,800 years from now. I'm just saying, so it's not going to return for 1,800 years. So I'm saying it's no wonder that we don't know it's there, even if scientists have agreed, which I have heard, that there is a Planet X or an invisible planet. Something is causing the gravitational changes on Uranus, Neptune, and perhaps Pluto. This certainly is a possibility. Are there scientists who entertain this idea of Nibiru?
More and more, it has been observed by the infrared satellite, IRIS satellite, and a man named Charles Kowal at Palomar Observatory is looking for it actively right now. But there's variance in its prediction of when its imminent return will be.
Let's talk about some of these collisions. So Nibiru has stayed together even though it's collided? Or were you saying that it had collided with other planets, or that there have been ancient collisions that have caused some of the planets that we have?
Well, the source of the material is from the Babylonian epic called the Enuma Elish, which is their story of creation. And Sitchin's interpretation of it is the return of Nibiru every 3,600 years. And basically, at one juncture, its moon, called Kingu, collided with a planet that existed between Mars and Jupiter at that time, and it's called Tiamat.
Now, some others have referred to that planet as Maldek. Is that correct?
I've heard that as well. Different cultures, different times, have different names for many of the planets, as you know, just as they had different names of the gods themselves, mm-hmm. which were based on the 12 planets.
So is this where the asteroid belt came from?
Exactly, from this collision of Kingu and Tiamat. According to the ancient records, the top half of Tiamat actually became the Earth. It was propelled into the orbit of the current day Earth. The bottom part of that planet was shattered into bits that became the asteroid belt, and even parts of the moon that collided became our comets today. And a lot of this is verifiable through astronomics.
So we're actually living on the top half of some other planet. Is this according to Sitchin?
This is according to the Sumerian Babylonian records of even the more ancient tales, which were actually histories that were passed down to the people 4,000 years ago. And this is Sitchin's interpretation.
Who are the Anunnaki?
Well, we have to jump forward quite a bit in history from the creation of the Earth, which we just did. And then we get to another passing of Nibiru and what's now the Earth. And they came down 60 at a time, according to the records. And the Earth-based rank-and-file Nephilim were called the Anunnaki. And they were sent here to Earth, according to the records, to find gold, of all things. Because on the home planet of Nibiru, the atmosphere was found to be thinning like ours is today, and they discovered that by suspending gold particles in the atmosphere, it would maintain it. So
okay,
they were
now
actually here on Earth looking for gold.
Okay, I've got to get this thing together. So the Nephilim were really known as the Anunnaki, is that correct? I'm missing this, I think.
A faction of the Nephilim that came to Earth were called the Anunnaki.
Okay.
The ones that maintained the space shuttles at the time that brought the gold from Earth to the space flat platforms and then back to Nibiru were called the Igigi. And what's interesting here is that if you read any of the scholars who study ancient Sumerian, they're very familiar with these terms, okay, the Anunnaki and the Igigi, but of course they give them legendary metaphysical status. They don't understand the sky gods, the Igigi. This is, again, passing through the ideological barrier that to fly about in the skies is not something metaphysical when you actually have spacecraft, as the Nephilim did 450,000 years ago.
So in a sense, we could say the Igigi were like our present-day astronauts.
I was watching them up in space, right, just yesterday, which is an interesting thing, how our technology today is reaching the point that the Nephilim were that a half a million years ago, and now we can understand our genesis, our biogenetic genesis, and occurrences on the planet.
All right, so the Anunnaki were kind of like what, service workers? They were people that maybe traveled on the spacecraft that came down to Earth, and they were like what, miners?
That's right, Bruce. According to the records, they were mining in southern Africa, southeastern Africa originally. And again, the archaeological record shows some extremely old mines in that part of the world. We don't know who the miners were, but it looks like the Anunnaki were the workers until a time of their mutiny. There was a rebellion of the Anunnaki, and this precipitated the creation of the human race.
Okay, now I have to stop for a moment and ask you this. Are you telling us, and this is what I think I'm getting here, that the only reason that the Nephilim even came to the Earth was because they needed gold?
It looks like the main reason, whatever their entire agenda was, it's too long ago for us to figure.
All right. And you are also saying, because you just implied something, may have gone by some of the listeners, it did not go by me, you implied that Homo sapien or mankind was not on the Earth at this point.
Exactly, and that's an important point. There were vast lengths of time where this planet was inhabited by the gods, the Nephilim, before the human race was created. They did many genetic experiments and brought many living things to the planet. There was a primitive ape creature at that time. But after the Anunnaki mutinied, according to the records, there was a meeting amongst the Nephilim to decide on creating a worker species through the combining of their genetic material and the ape creature's genetic material to create a hybrid who was strong enough to work in their mines, yet intelligent enough to follow their orders. And this is the story of Ea, or Enki, who was the leader of the Nephilim in the Abzu, the underworld in Africa, and how he and Ninhursag, his scientist assistant, created the human race in a laboratory.
Let's come back to the mining of gold for a moment. To outward appearances, these look like pyramids to us, don't they?
Right.
They were originally just built that way. I guess that was how they built their mines.
Well, no, this is getting far ahead of the story. There was a time period when they exhausted their mining in Africa and they looked towards foreign lands for more gold. This takes us up to the third millennium BC when they began building the pyramids in South America. That's what you're referring to. Mm-hmm. And those were metallurgical centers, as many archaeologists are now coming to the conclusion. But if you're referring to the pyramids in Egypt, again, we're skipping over.
Okay, let's leave it then for a moment. Let's go back then for a moment. Creation of Homo sapien in, you say, the Eden.
The word Din-Gir was the Sumerian word for gods. Eden meant the place of the gods. It was located in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, which is modern-day southern Iraq. And this was the place where Enlil, the chieftain of the Nephilim, had his laboratory of creation, they called it, where he sent out into the world seeds and fruits and animals and even the original creation of the Adapa, or the Adam, who was brought to this garden. That's where it existed.
Adam, A-D-A-M, the first man, or the first man that we know about.
Well, again, to change one's thinking, we modern people think we're very sophisticated, and when it comes to stories of Adam and Eve, or the Tower of Babel, or the Flood, we tend to take them as allegories, if you're sophisticated, or take them literal, perhaps, if you're a fundamentalist. But we don't realize that they are fragments of ancient stories that were the histories of what occurred with the first collaboration between the gods and man. So the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, the symbology is very warped through our modern misconceptions, and Sitchin will trace the linguistics of certain words like the rib of Adam being the Sumerian word ti, which they used puns in Sumerian. Not only does it mean rib, but it actually means life energy or a gene. And then we get into genetics, which are mentioned in the ancient records. But of course, up until recently, when we now have this biogenetic technology, no one could interpret these ancient tales in a scientific manner. So again, we have to somehow throw aside our belief systems to look at it in a new way and to recontextualize our knowledge. And that's why these ideas are so powerful. They explain many previously unexplained aspects of our being here. The missing link has never been found. We've now just explained it through a genetic manipulation. And now we're talking about some of the tales of the Bible, and that they were actually history that occurred, such as the Flood.
All right, yeah, I was just going to say, let's talk about the Flood specifically, because that seems to be one that every indigenous culture talks about a flood, whether they were connected or not.
It seemed to have been a global phenomenon. Sitchin says it happened around 11,000 BC, according to the records. Everywhere it's mentioned, as you say, in all cultures all around the world. There's a curious list called the Sumerian King List, which lists the length of reigns of the various rulers, and it's divided into the rulers of before the deluge and after the deluge. And this is one of the most important artifacts that modern archaeologists use to study the length of the different dynasties of that time. And it's quite accurate, but this dividing line of the deluge is what separates prehistory to history, because after the deluge, it took another 6,000 years till the 6th millennium BC for civilization to start again in the Middle East.
Let's talk a little bit about the Egyptian, Sumerian, Indus Valley civilizations, because that is appropriate at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, historians have now found the origin of civilization to be the Sumerians, and that would have been 3000 BC. 500 years after that is when the Egyptian civilization rose, and about that same time over in the India Pakistan region of the Indus Valley, another great ancient civilization formed. And the connection between these three civilizations sets a backdrop to the extraordinary tales of the wars that existed amongst these gods and the armies of men that they employed.
Are you saying then the Sumerians are not just Homo sapiens?
Well, we all are a genetic combination. We have a bicameral genetic base from the Nephilim and the Earth people. That's you included.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad I'm included. I'd hate to be excluded from this thing. Well, I think what I'm asking you is they walked hand in hand with the gods, so to speak, didn't they?
This was an axiomatic assumption of the Sumerians. The scholars who read these Sumerian records are astounded at the frankness of the stories, how they fed the gods food in their temples, how they stood and sat side by side with these humanoid, flesh and blood, earthy gods. What does that mean? Again, we have to look at it with fresh eyes and say that they meant exactly what they said, that they didn't write records to confuse us when we find these tales 6,000 years later.
So the point is that the Sumerians were engineered, let's say, or the Homo sapiens were engineered by the Nephilim, and at this point, are we still regarded then, I guess, as less than, but still able to live with? We're kind of, I mean, Homo sapiens were engineered as workers, weren't they?
Right.
I mean, that's what you said. I mean, they were the ones that were made to be able to follow directions and be strong enough to mine the gold ore that the Nephilim needed.
Well, the remnants of these ancient memories explain a lot of our behavior today. This master-slave relationship goes very deep into the human race.
Let's talk for a moment. We've talked about the Egyptian-Sumerian civilizations. We've talked about the flood. We've talked about Nephilim, which was the name of these particular people that came from a planet known as Nibiru. What is Marduk?
Marduk was the Babylonian name for the planet Nibiru. It was also the name of their chief deity, Marduk. A little bit of background to the pantheon of the gods, which is one of Zacharias Sitchin's unique contributions, is the interchangeable names of the gods through the different civilizations. The 12 great gods of Sumeria were the same 12 Olympian gods of Greece.
Now, I've got to stop for a second. You know, for those of you who may be listening or fundamentalists, please, we're using the word God very loosely here. We're not in any way espousing something that is either not Christian or Hindu or something like that, but we are using the term very loosely, meaning that the way that these other humanoids were regarded because of their incredible knowledge, strength, wisdom, was that they referred to as gods. Does that sound...
Exactly. The word theos, god, was a Greek contribution. We can call them the Anunnaki, who were here on Earth, the Ililu, the Watchers, the Shining Ones, the Custodians. They were referred by many names through many millennia. But interesting, the same gods, and you ought to see lists of hundreds and hundreds of Greek gods, of Egyptian gods, of Sumerian gods. Each city, each town, each village had a patron god who instructed them in their arts of agriculture and mathematics and woodworking and husbandry and all the arts of civilization. And whenever these ancient people were asked where they learned how to do what they did, they said it came from the gods who came from heaven.
So in a sense, these people, these higher, let's call them extraterrestrials just for the sake of the ufology community, they came down and they taught. They said, you want to learn how to grow corn? Here exactly. It is. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. Here's how to do it. Is this my understanding?
Oh, yeah, they were the original instructors of civilization, architecture. Some of the most ancient architecture seems very alien to the earth if you've ever seen the Temple of Baalbek or the ancient pyramids. Some of these structures, the monolithic structures with 1,200-ton stones, which we can't even lift with our engineering feats today, were built by the gods for purposes that only the gods really knew. The Great Pyramid, for instance, was built, according to the ancient records, in 11,000 BC after the flood, and it was built as a landing beacon, what's called a theodolite, which was lined up with Mount Ararat in northern Turkey, and the Temple of Baalbek and the pyramids are on a straight line, and this acted as a landing beacon for the Anunnaki vehicles. And there's a great history that involved the Great Pyramid in Egypt. In fact, interesting to read many of the Egyptologists who still believe that Khufu, the pharaoh of the Egyptian dynasty, built the Great Pyramid, because Sitchin has some rather extraordinary and unique evidence that shows that Khufu could not have been the builder of the pyramid. The only bit of evidence that ever attached Khufu to the Great Pyramid was a cartouche painted in red paint in the hidden chambers up above the king's chamber. And it turns out that this was a forgery by a man named Weiss, who was one of the original British explorers about 100 years ago of the Great Pyramid. And the fact of this forgery was confirmed by one of the assistants of this man. His grandson wrote Zachariah Sitchin a letter, and this is all explained in the book The Stairway to Heaven. It's just incredible that most scholars still believe that the collapsed pyramid shows that they were built by people who made a few mistakes and then improved upon those mistakes. And after the Pyramid of Zoser collapsed, they then built the Pyramids of Giza. But this is totally wrong. The prototypes were built by the gods, and when the people of Egypt tried to imitate these architectural constructions, they failed, and that's why the Pyramid of Zoser collapsed.
So that was one of the imitations, huh?
Exactly.
All right. Now, let's talk for a moment about the Sumerian civilization. It came to an end. I don't think that I remember anyone ever telling me how it came to an end. What is your understanding?
There are records that are vivid descriptions of a massive destruction that occurred instantaneously, and the descriptions of the horrors of the end of that civilization sound a lot like a nuclear holocaust, including radiation, sickness, and burns. And some of the evidence that's found in these tales points to the technology that these Nephilim were using as weapons at that time, that were nuclear and in effect created nuclear clouds that were blown by the winds over the Sumerian civilization and actually spelled the end of that chapter of history.
Just for, I don't know, timeline here, we have the Egyptians starting about, did you say 500 years after the end of the Sumerians? Is that what you said?
2500.
2500.
2500 BC, Egyptian, and the Sumerians were 3000 BC.
So yes, about 500
years. 500 years after. In fact, some of the connections between these civilizations can be seen by the movements of the gods themselves. For instance, Marduk in Babylon was also known as Ra in Egyptian. His father, the Egyptians called Ptah, and his father was called by the Sumerians Enki. And Marduk was looking for a place that he could be the ruling deity. And this created a lot of conflict amongst some of his other siblings, brothers, half-brothers, even half-sister. And the stories of these gods and the wars that they fought shaped the destiny of these ancient civilizations. Marduk at one time was imprisoned within the Great Pyramid, the house that looked like a mountain, according to these ancient records. And that's a fascinating tale that might be too much depth to go into right now.
Let's do it.
Well, Marduk's imprisonment in the Great Pyramid due to some warring factions of the Nephilim involving Inanna, Ishtar, and Dumuzi actually explains a lot of the internal passageways of the pyramid. Again, modern Egyptologists cannot explain some of the passageways beneath the pyramid. But Marduk's imprisonment and his eventual escape fall into a scenario, again analyzed by Sitchin, which explains every passageway within the pyramid. When Marduk finally was released, he was sent back, or he went back to Babylon, and the story of the Tower of Babel was the story of Marduk and his followers attempting to erect a tower that reached unto the heavens, or a space platform that the other gods thought was not a very good idea, and was destroyed by the Enlilites, another faction of the Nephilim, and humanity at that time was dispersed around the earth, and many languages were created.
Well, the story of the I was going to say the story of the languages is according to this, is not that everyone started speaking a different language while they were building it?
No, that's part of our modern superstitious mythology, and not a deeper understanding of what these myths, which really preserved the facts of what occurred in ancient times, really are all about.
All right, so the legends, the myths, the gods, these are actually historically found, and I guess Sitchin has found tremendous evidence through his linguistic work.
It's fascinating, Bruce, just the whole cast of characters and how interchangeable they are from the different cultures. I'd like to just take one line of thought, which was a son of Marduk's, whose name, I would say, is Ningishzuda in the Sumerian. In Egyptian times, he was known as Thoth, and this great skilled god, the word skill is often translated as wisdom, so if you call him a god of wisdom, it's really the fact that he was skilled, and he was skilled in the use of metals and metallurgy, and when he went to the New World, he was known as Quetzalcoatl, according to Sitchin's studies in The Lost Realms, which adds another fascinating chapter to the story of the Nephilim's movements here on the Earth. Quetzalcoatl, of course, was that great god that came from the East, who gave the ancient Mayans and then the Aztecs and the Incas their civilization.
So what we're seeing at every step here is a very normal, natural, pragmatic evolution of ideas being taught by beings who have come from a planet that was more advanced than the Earth.
Yes, this is no great metaphysical speculation. We're talking about the lost history of our planet. We've now found the records, and we're reading them and interpreting them. So when Quetzalcoatl, for instance, arrived in South America, we can trace his arrival to the year 3113 BC, which is the exact date that the Mayan long calendar began. We trace all of our calendars from the time of great personages on the earth. Of course, our modern calendar is from the time of the birth of Christ. Of course, the Jewish calendar began 5,280 some years ago, but why? If you ask your rabbi, he might say, well, that was the beginning of the world. Well, actually, we have a record that on the date of the beginning of the Jewish calendar, which was based on the calendar of Nippur, which was the city of Anu in Sumeria, the arrival of Anu, who was the entire leader of the Nephilim back on their home planet Nibiru. It was his arrival on Earth and the great celebration of his visitation that began that entire calendrical cycle.
So we have a very synergistic thing happening here, namely all of the diverse religions everything that we're hearing about is just other names for the same thing that happened. We've got now ancient mysteries. They're not mysteries according to Sitchin, are they?
Well, we can leave them as ancient mysteries, or we can start to believe the facts that are right before our eyes. Again, there seems to be a problem with scientists today and rationally thinking people to see what's right in front of their eyes, and the attempt to explain away these ancient mysteries. We see UFOs in our skies today. We have pictures, photographs, videotapes of them, yet many people refuse to believe their own eyes. We have the records of our ancient past. All that we need to do is read them.
Temples, pyramids, ziggurats. What are they, according to Sitchin?
Well, the architectural styles of the ziggurats of Sumeria and the Near East are near identical to those found in South America, such as the ones at Tiahuanacan and the temples of the moon and the sun, and Chichen Itza, Palenque. The idea is that there's a diffusion theory that came from a central place, which was Sumeria, which was our ancient progenitors, these gods who taught us how to build. So when one studies these ancient structures, at a certain point, we go back far enough in time that the same people were responsible for their constructions. And they had a utilitarian function. Many people listening right now, I know, have an understanding that the temples, the pyramids, were used as initiation places and have to do with our own spiritual development. And they very well may be. There's a multifaceted use of these structures. In fact, no one's discounting the use of pyramids as tombs in later days, when in fact the Egyptians entered these buildings that were built by and for the gods, and they did some reconstructive work, some remodeling, and in fact used them as burial chambers. But that wasn't their original function.
What was their original function? You can't leave us there, Norman.
Well, we've mentioned the Great Pyramids being a part of a landing beam theodolite mechanism. We mentioned the temples in South America as being metallurgical centers. So basically, they were functional for this technology that the Nephilim used that we are just beginning to grasp.
All right. Now, evolution. According to Darwin, of course, all happened quite by accident, kind of like the idea that if you had an explosion in a print factory, you would end up with Webster's Dictionary. You're saying this was actual genetic engineering that was going on.
Of course, evolution is a theory, Darwin's theory of evolution. It is not a fact, and there seem to be many cracks in the theory that are beginning to widen these days. Of course, we have our controversy between evolution versus creation, but this idea of creation by extraterrestrials is a bit of a synthesis that ameliorates the situation and explains them both. You have natural evolution, of course, we've observed it, but that's microevolution. It's within species, it's variations within species, but we've never observed the origin of a new species. That has not occurred. And we're postulating that the only way it can occur is through genetics, understanding how our biogenetic material can be manipulated, and gene splicing and cloning techniques are something that we're just beginning to understand. But the Nephilim knew about it 500,000 years ago.
All right, so basically what we're talking about then is that we are on the advent, the beginning of a new paradigm shift, one where we will all begin to understand genetic engineering as being natural, normal. Unfortunately, we're looking at humans creating something that's not in the chain versus, I suppose I should give these, the Nephilim, more credit. They were probably more adept at genetic engineering than we are.
They were a bit in advance of where we are today. Of course.
So we're playing, aren't we? I mean, this is kind of playing around.
Well, we've already combined the genetic code of a goat and a sheep, and we've made what's called a geep. We have. In fact, we're more advanced genetically than most people would even believe. There are certain moral and ethical issues, of course, that are slowing down some
now,
of
can
the
we
research.
Get, yeah.
But it's extraordinary what we can do when we start to play God, if you will.
All right. Archaeolinguistics.
Well, this is the backbone of Sitchin's theories. And when one studies certain words that, again, are out of place from the records that they're found in, that could only refer to a technology far in advance, one begins to get a new picture, a new flash of the whole context in which we need to hold ancient history. For instance, there's a word Shem, which has been translated as raising a name for themselves. Whereas in the Tower of Babel story, the word Shem means that which rises up when it's studied linguistically. And then one can begin to think that there were craft that could rise into the sky. And there's many references of flying chariots, and these can be interpreted as vehicles which the sky gods were airborne in ancient times. There's stories in the Mahabharata, in the Ramayana, of what's called the Vimanas, which were the flying vehicles that existed thousands of years ago. And texts have recently been found about how the ancient people even constructed these vehicles. Every culture, whether they're called sky boats, or whether they're called plume serpents, or cherubim, which is the throne that the Lord flew in, these are words that up until recent times couldn't be understood except metaphorically. Now we can begin to grasp what they were really witnessing.
Quick question, Noah's Ark. Was that really a boat?
This is really a boat, perhaps a submergible boat, according to Sitchin's interpretation of the Babylonian story of the flood, which, by the way, is a vastly expanded version of the few fragments that are found in Genesis. But yes, Ut-Nap-Hashim in Babylonian, Zasudra, or Noah, as we know him, was befriended by Enki, a benefactor of humanity, and the seed of humanity did survive the flood.
Well, folks, we are literally running out of time. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today, Norman Cohan, ancient astronaut researcher. So much to talk about. Once again, the five books by Zechariah Sitchin are?
The 12th Planet, The Stairway to Heaven, Wars of Gods and Men, The Lost Realms, and Genesis Revisited.
Any other books that you suggest people look at or read if they're interested?
Well, The Gods of Eden traces the probable influence of the Nephilim from these ancient times through the Middle Ages up until our times. The Gods of Eden by William Bromley, I would highly recommend.
You are an author, also a poet. You're the creator of transformational software. Do you have something to tell us?
Well, encoded within our own genes are four terrestrial circuits and four post-terrestrial circuits, and I believe that that's an inheritance that we have from the Nephilim. So I have written what I call the Overmind series, and I consider it the activation of the higher circuits in my own genetic code. And I can finish this day with a piece that I call The Question. And I think that's what we'll all be left with after this. So the question is, where are the guardians, the gods, the guides, above us, below us, abounding on all sides, in a trance, transcending or in transition, an outer and or interior vision, neither this nor that, both dead and alive, hereafter or here, riddles Schrodinger's cat. The game is over, and over the mind, the overmind has superbly well-timed an epigenetic entelechy, understanding waves of uncertainty. The answer has heretofore been found. Nothing is ever as real as it seems, wherever, whenever, forever, indeed, dreams. Within dreams, within dreams.
All right, thank you very much, Norman Cohen. Thank you all for tuning in Timeless Voyager Radio. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.
Oh.